Welcome to Game On with Grace, where we're not just talking cricket wins and losses, we're talking off-field antics, guilty pleasures, and the drive that never quits. Hi everyone, I'm Grace Hayden. Welcome to Game On. Today we're joined by a very special guest who's truly done it all. On the pitch, behind the mic, and more recently in a coaching role. Alex Hartley is a World Cup winning England cricketer who spun her way into the history books in 2017, helped transform women's cricket in England, crossed hemispheres to play in Australia, and now brings all of her knowledge and insight of the game into the media landscape, as well as having a winning podcast, No Balls. We'll talk all things about her journey in the cricket world, her big career pivots into media and coaching, and how she balances honesty, fun and pressure in cricket culture. Game on. Alex, welcome to Game On with Grace. So stoked to have you on here. How are you? Where are you, first of all?
I'm very well, thank you. When I got the call saying, will I do it? I was like, absolutely, if it's with you, of course. I'm currently at home, which is really nice. So we were out in Sri Lanka together. So I've not been at work since, so I don't really know what to do with myself.
You got to take those moments though, because with our jobs, you never know where you're going to be here or there. And so if you have moments at home, you really got to just take a minute and go, okay, woosah. And I mean, that Sri Lanka trip home for you, we were just talking about it before we started recording. This was the last time that I saw you, because we were, you know, seeing you a couple of times in Sri Lanka between, you know, Colombo and Kandy. But then we saw you in the airport on the way home and oh my gosh, you had a whirlwind. Please tell us what went on.
So obviously with the Gulf War happening, my flight was cancelled. So I got to the airport and my flight was cancelled. I was like, okay, no worries. So I booked another one there and then. I was like, I'll just get on this one. But this one was going to Amsterdam. So it was going to Delhi to Amsterdam. That got cancelled. So I was like, okay, what do I do? So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to get out the airport. Bumped into you and Erin, and you were both like, oh, how's it going? I was like, I hope your flight is going the right way because I can't get on one for love nor money. Luckily, you guys were going to Singapore and then on to Australia, which gave me the idea that I need to go that way, which is the longest way home. Like, it is honestly ridiculous. But I couldn't get my bag for like 4 hours. So I had to wait in the airport for 4 hours. Got my bag eventually about 3 p.m. I saw you at like, what, 10 a.m., something like that?
10 a.m., yeah, because we had a morning flight or mid-morning kind of.
So I hadn't been to bed. So I went, we did the game in Kandy and I travelled back from Kandy, went straight to the airport.
Basically 3 to 5 hours a journey. So that's a long enough stint in a car sitting down.
Yeah, so I'd done that journey, got my bag, went straight to the airport, flight was cancelled, got out the airport at 3 p.m, got back to the hotel, didn't have a room. I was like, oh my God, you have to be kidding me. I was like, don't shout at anybody, it's nobody's fault, it's nobody's fault, it's nobody's fault. You know, like one of those where you're like, don't be a princess, don't be a princess. Got in my room and just got out the shower and my phone rang and said, you've got a flight tonight. So I was like, okay, perfect. So I was like, let me just go back to the airport where I've just come from, which is an hour away. Went back to the airport, queued up. The queue was like an hour long. And I was like, okay, I'll get in this queue. Got to the front of the desk and they were like, oh no, you're on the waiting list. You're not even on the flight.
No. Oh my God. How did you stay calm? How did you stay calm?
Because if I did anything else, I would have cried because I hadn't slept for 2 days. I was like, oh my God. So I just said to the woman, I was like, oh, you're joking. I said, I've been in this airport now for 16 hours. I was like, I just need to get on this flight. She was like, let me see what I can do. She was like, please, can you go and wait over there really patiently? I was like, of course, anything I can do to help you, you just let me know. I was like, anyway, I got on. It was fine. Went to Singapore and then 16 hours to Heathrow and then 2 hours here. So it was fine.
Oh my gosh, what a whirlwind. Holy wow.
So the fact I now don't have work till the 10th of May, I think is quite deserved.
Well, you actually do deserve that that break at home just to ease the mind because far out, I don't know how you kept your cool. I would have actually had a meltdown.
I know. I was like, it's nobody's fault. The fact that I got on one plane and then got deboarded was the heartbreaking moment.
Yeah, because that's when we saw you. You'd already been on the plane and you'd waited on the plane for how long?
We were on the plane for, I think, an hour and a half. And then they decided that us being in Delhi was, and then going from Delhi to Amsterdam was more of a problem because we'd be stuck in India than us being stuck in Sri Lanka.
So either way, you were screwed. But anyway, you're here now, you're having a break, and you're a lot more relaxed. You look glowing, actually.
Thank you.
It's time for a quick break. Stick around and we'll be right back. All right, well, let's get into this new segment called Human Behind the Hype. So pretty much the concept is we get to know you as a person outside of all the accolades and all your achievements. Now, I want to start first by asking, where did cricket start for you?
Oh, that's a great question. I was quite late to cricket, so none of my family ever played, which is really unusual for a female, especially of my era. I think girls now start without family. But I lived on an estate full of boys, so they all played football, so I played football. And then one Friday night, I went to the trees where we used to meet up on a Friday. Because before phones, so it was like you just used to turn up somewhere and hope everyone was there. And one Friday night, nobody was there. And I was like, oh, where is everybody? So I went to the nearest house and said to Kim, who was one of the mums, where are the boys? Oh, they're up at the cricket club. So I was like, okay. So I ran home and I said to my mum, can I go to cricket? She was like, no. I was like, what do you mean? She's like, you do every sport under the sun. She's like, not another one. She's like, you've got gymnastics tomorrow, then you've got swimming, then you've got football. And I was like, please. She's like, no. I was like, the bar's open. She was like, come on, then.
I love that's how you convinced her. You're like, okay, fine. Get in the car, love. Let's go.
Yeah, so we went up one Friday night and I instantly fell in love with it. And it must have been not only because cricket as a sport like brings you together with all your friends, but all my friends were already there and I sort of already knew everybody. So it almost felt like I'd been going for such a long time. So yeah, I just completely fell in love with it.
And then from there, when did you go, oh, I'm actually quite good at this sport. I think I'm going to make it to the next level.
Oh, that's, I never believed I was any good. Like, even when I've made it, I sort of always had that self-doubt. And it was really strange because when I was growing up, you know, I sort of, at 12 years old, I'd made my first team debut for Lancs, which was so young. And I remember my mum being stood at fine leg with me. She's like, are you okay? I was like, I'm just a kid, like I'm just a baby. And then I sort of was in and out the England Academy and I knew I was good enough, but because I'd never made it until I was quite late in life, I sort of almost never believed I would. So it was all, it was almost like I knew I was good enough, but I'm not good enough at the same time. And then I made my debut at 24, maybe 22, 24, something like that. It was quite late. And I was like, and it was the worst game of my life. I hated every single second of it. So it was, I had a really strange career in the fact that I worked so hard to do it. And then when I'd done it, I didn't really enjoy it.
Really? That's so surprising. Was it just that self-doubt of and the pressure that builds? I mean, being a professional athlete, you know, you have so much pressure on you at all times, a lot self, a lot from others. But what was it that you really went, I'm not quite enjoying this as much as I feel like, was it as much as what I feel like I should be, or what was it?
I think it's because my debut was so bad that I was almost like, so we were playing Pakistan, to put it into context, and back then they weren't very good. I think they got 180 and I'd gone for 50 of those runs in my 10 overs. And the captain, bless her, Heather Knight, I mean, she was brilliant for me. You know, she calmed me down in every scenario. But I didn't bowl very well, none for 50. And I was just a bit like, oh, this isn't for me. And then my mum said to me at the end of the game, which stuck with me forever, she was like, no one's going to take it away from you. You've now got your England cap. That's it. That's all you ever wanted. She said, if you never play again, then you've achieved everything you wanted to in life. And I was almost like, okay, I can sort of like breathe a little bit now. And I was like crying. I was going, I hate my life. She's like, Alex, stop being dramatic.
As how moms nice do. To be able to lean on your mum in that way too, in such a vulnerable moment, you know, to have that person who's always, you know, got you too.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I got picked for the West Indies tour a few months later. Yeah. And I was playing a warm-up game and I just didn't know where the ball was going. And I was like, I'm just not made out for this. You know, some people are really good at like domestic cricket, but they're just not made out for international cricket, or they're not made out for international sport. I was like, I'm one of those. I've tried. I'm not very good. And the head coach came to me and he was like, where were you a year ago? I was like, making sandwiches in a bakery for a full-time job. And he was like, where are you now? I was like, I'm in the West Indies. He went, get a grip and get on with it. You're playing tomorrow. And I was like, shit.
Like, right.
And that was, yeah. And that was almost like the wake-up call I needed of like, right, stop being dramatic. Like, obviously, I'm putting too much pressure on myself. And then played really well for a year and absolutely loved it. And then after the World Cup, again, just started putting too much pressure on myself. So stopped enjoying it and never really managed to get out of that cycle of anxiety and hating the game. So it was a bit of a shame, really.
But I feel like that would happen to a lot of athletes too. You definitely wouldn't be alone in that. And, you know, I know that you've been really open about taking a break from cricket for mental health reasons, like you've just mentioned. I mean, anxiety, I feel like it would be such a normal thing for any athlete to experience, and you do ebb and flow with it. But, you know, when was that moment after the World Cup or during the World Cup that you went, no, I need to actually step away from the game now?
It was a few years later. So I played the 2017 World Cup and played for England for a couple of years. And then a couple of girls came through that were better than me. And that happens. I was very, very open to that happening. And, you know, like that we're actually all friends now. You know, that's part of life. If someone comes into a job, they're better than you. They're going to take your job. Like that happens. But it wasn't until, I think it was COVID in 2020, that I sort of went, okay, I've lost my England contract. Now COVID's hit. I actually don't have a job. And I was like, okay, I'll see if I get an ECB contract domestically, for Lanx. And I was like, let's see if that happens. COVID hit, didn't happen. I ended up having to go to the paper, which was really bad. But being like, we've been promised these contracts. Yes, COVID's hit, but I'm an adult with a house and a mortgage, and I can't pay my bills because this contract has just been put on hold. So then started being paid professionally again. And then in 2021, I started balancing commentary and playing, and I was captain of Lanx, and I was like, this is just too much. I didn't have a day off for about 3 years. And then I don't even know when I retired now, Grace, to be honest with you. It was nearly 3 summers ago, but I was just like, it's just getting too much. I'm away all winter commentating. I'm expected to come back and play well, or I'm expecting myself to come back and play well. I don't think the team were. I think they were very understanding in the fact that they were probably waiting for my performances to get worse to drop me because I was never there.
Stop it right now. Stop it.
But it was all in my head, you know. I really, really struggled mentally. I remember just going to cricket training, coming back crying. You know, going to work, loving it, going to cricket, coming back crying. And I met my agent and he just looked at me and he's like, you're not going to cricket training. He said, go and tell them you're not coming back. And I was like, what do you mean? He went, no, you need a break. And that was the moment for me. I was like, I'm not myself. I'm really hating it. I'm hating life, which is not like me at all. So I turned up to cricket training in my Crocs and they were like, are you ready? I was like, no, I'm just coming to say bye. So I had a break for a couple of months. The 100 came around and I was like, right, I'm going to play in that and then I'm going to retire, because the 100 is so good it's just great fun. It's an amazing tournament. So I had to have therapy before and after every game to get through that. And I was just, remember halfway through the 100 thinking, oh, it's too much. It's too mentally tiring. And I'd be like in a team meeting going 1, 2, 3, 4, 9, 10. Oh shit, I'm 11th. Or the next day being like, oh my God, I'm 12th, I'm not playing. And that's just not how it should be. You should be enjoying it. You know, it's your dream to play. So as soon as I started wishing I wasn't playing, I knew it was time to pull the plug.
Yeah. And then your transition into commentary, obviously you were commentating while playing, as you just said, but where did that opportunity arise? And when did you go, I actually really enjoy this element of the game?
Everyone always says this, how did you get into commentary? Is it something you wanted to do? And I fell into it, literally fell into it. So my first ever day was in 2017. We played the doubleheader at Old Trafford and somebody had to go home for a family emergency. And I got a message from Henry Moran saying, do you fancy being on the radio? I was like, all right then. We'd just played a game and then it was Lanx versus Worcester, the men afterwards. And I remember Joss Butler hitting this massive six. And the commentator says, that's six from Joss Butler. Alex, how do you sum it up? And I was like, you're on the radio, you got to speak. Oops. So I just stayed silent. I was so overwhelmed. I didn't know what was happening. And then in the start of 2020, in the January, I went traveling the United States because I'd lost my England contract. I'd not really done much since 2017. And I was in LA and I just got a phone call saying, do you fancy doing the Women's World Cup out in Australia? And I said, oh, I'd love to for the BBC. I was like, I'd absolutely love to. Slight problem, and I'm in LA. And they're like, not a problem. We'll get you to Australia. And then I've basically been full-time ever since.
Oh, how cool. And the radio, like, have you done a bunch of TV as well? Like that it's obviously a very different niche in the entertainment space and in broadcasting. How did you get used to, okay, I've actually got to call every moment that's happening because the listener, I should say, can't actually see what is happening?
Yeah. So I started with radio. So that's my like cricket love now is the radio when I go and do that, because it's just storytelling and just, I love a yarn and I love chatting. So I'm like, okay, this is amazing. Started off on the radio, then started doing more and more TV with the BBC. And now it's actually so different flicking between the two, because you do have to sort of remember that, one, the audience can't see anything, and two, like when you are on TV, sometimes talking is too much. You just want to watch. But you sort of do get used to it.
Yeah, absolutely. The more you do of anything, obviously, you get used to it. And then now you're also dabbling in the coaching world as well. How's that been as a different element? You've really tried every facet of cricket. It's so good.
Well, I was the PSL's now and I've not heard anything, so I guess I don't have that job anymore. with our owner changing. That fell upon me again, you know, these amazing opportunities just keep falling at my lap, which I'll always say yes to them, because I think it's you should try everything in life. But the coaching side of things, I felt like a bit of a fraud, because I'd gone from playing and commentating straight into an elite environment and coaching grown men. And that shouldn't be intimidating, but it is. You know, I'd not done any academy coaching, not really done much before. I'd done a little bit, but when I was younger. So I was coaching Multan Sultans as their spin bowling coach, did 2 seasons and loved it. Absolutely loved it. It was something completely different. It got me away from the game in a totally different way, but it also helped my commentary as well, because then I'd be like, oh, I've coached these blokes or I've seen these blokes play for a month and brought it into my commentary. So I'm a little bit gutted I'm not there this year, because it's something completely different and fun, but the owner's changed and, you know, Bob's your uncle.
It is what it is sometimes.
Yeah.
Meant to be, hey.
Yeah, so if your dad needs a spin bowling coach, I'm not doing anything.
Yeah, all right, I'll let him know. Alex Hartley's pretty good. Okay, well, as we all know that this, you know, job, it takes us all around the world, and cricket's only just getting bigger and bigger, and touching so many different countries that, I mean, I personally didn't think that it would ever touch. I mean, America's a huge market that, you know, I feel like it's starting to really break into. But, you know, that requires a lot of travel and a lot of long stints away from home. How do you navigate that?
It's a good, great question. That it's something you sort of get used to, and you'll be the same, where your little pockets at home. Home's not a place. It's either a person or your people.
I totally agree with that. That is, yeah, I say the same thing. It really is the people that you love, and, you know, home is where you make it.
Yeah. So, like, I haven't been technically at home since September, but I'm with my partner, so it feels like I'm at home. And then I'll pop over to Manchester for a day or two here and there, or I'll go and see mum and dad. But, you know, my parents are my home, my brother's my home. So I guess with me being away so much, mum and dad always try and come abroad and see me when I'm away, which is a real privilege. And I'm very, very lucky that they can do that. They actually said to me the other day, where are you next February? So where are we going? Because they always spend February away from home. So they spent February in Sri Lanka with me. And I said, oh, next February, Sri Lanka. They were like, okay, well, no, we're not doing that again.
They don't like it.
No, they left early.
I didn't know this, because we were in the same hotel and I remember meeting them, and they're so, so sweet. But they didn't like it. That's so funny.
No, I've actually got a picture of you and your dad actually having a drink on our first day. So I was taking a picture of the sunset and I was like, oh, those two people are in my picture. And then I looked at it, I was like, oh, it's Grace.
So good. Yeah, we're blocking you.
Well, I didn't recognise either of you. Do you know when you just not expected it? Your dad's got a new bonnet as well, so I just exactly. I didn't recognise him.
Front that's like flowing at the front. He's this random chick with him.
Yeah, I was like, oh. I was like, should we play if they're together or daughter and dad?
No, it's actually so weird the amount of times that happened. I actually feel like I have to like preface. No, he's my dad. He is my dad.
I have to do the same. I do the same all the time. When me and my dad are in London and we go shopping and they're like, oh, is it for the lady? And my dad's like, daughter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it happens a lot. It's weird. It's just really, really yeah. weird. Have you got yeah. a favourite place that you've travelled to?
Oh, that's favourite place. Do you know what? Everyone's everywhere is so different, sorry. So incredibly lucky in the fact that, you know, Australia and New Zealand, brilliant places to go. New York, I mean, that World Cup was just incredible. I absolutely loved it. What they did out there was so good for the sport. Miami, you know, I was so lucky in the fact that I got to go there as well. And then the fact that I'm really sitting on the fence, your listeners are going to be like, Alex, but then the fact you get to go to Pakistan and India, you know, they're places that I wouldn't personally have gone unless it was for cricket. So I don't have a favourite place because I just feel really privileged in the fact that I get to go to all these places and experience all these different cultures that I probably wouldn't experience otherwise.
No, I totally agree with that. It's amazing what we get the opportunity to do. Do you have a routine or ritual when you first get to, I don't know, a different place that you know you're going to have for a long period of time? You've got maybe 5 weeks or whatever it might be, even if you are traveling here and there, like we were in Sri Lanka. Do you have that kind of ritual routine that you always want to tap into?
Do you know what I don't? I've got a really bad one in the fact that before the first game of every tournament, I've got to go out.
I'm so shocked.
Which just sort of happens because you'll know when you go on tour, everybody's together for the first time in such a long time that you all get really giddy. Yeah. And then you end up going for dinner and a couple of drinks. Yeah, yeah, it's so exciting to see everybody again. And then you go, 2 o'clock in the morning, we've got to go to bed, we've got work tomorrow. So that's an accidental ritual.
Yeah, I like it though, I rate it.
Yeah, I'm not an unpacker, so I don't unpack. I live out my suitcase because I just think it's going to be moved in a few days. What's the point? And everyone thinks I'm a proper psycho for that because I just live off the floor.
If it's if I'm only there for a few days and I know that I'm traveling back and forth, I'm definitely a suitcase liver. But if I know that I'm there for weeks, I am unpack everything, make it feel like my house. And I feel
so. How many days is your? I'm going to unpack now.
Probably like 2 weeks.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I've only just unpacked my suitcase here. And how long have I been at home?
Alex, no.
Well, it's not my house. I was like, I don't want to take advantage. And then the other day, it's like, oh, you've really made yourself at home.
And this here and this is here. Maybe I get a few plants or something, decorate.
Well, I nipped home for an appointment and came back with my slippers the other day. He's like, oh, you are making yourself at home then. I was like, yeah.
Yeah, you're getting real, real comfy.
Yeah.
I love it. So good. But I do yeah. the fact that, like, the ritual is you got to go out then at first night fever. It's good.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? It just means then your giddiness is out the way and you get to catch up with everybody. And I am very much of a Labrador. So if I don't see you and I see you at work, I'm like, oh, what have you been up to? And everyone's like, Alex, we're at work. Stop distracting us. So get it out of the way.
Distracting us. What? No, I reckon they secretly love it. They're just being negative.
Yeah, I reckon so.
It's time for a word from our sponsors. We'll be back in a minute with Alex.
To sports roundtable. So we're going to dig a little bit deeper into the world of sport and a little bit more about your career. I want you to take us back to 2017. And what's really the strongest memory of that World Cup win for you?
I think it was when we lost the first game. So we lost the first game to India, and it was a little bit of a shock to us all because we'd played so well in the build-up to the World Cup, and everything we'd spoken about was, you know, winning the World Cup, singing the song at Lourdes, and you lose that first game and it's just silent in the dressing room and it's anger from everybody and a little bit like, oh, Smriti Mandana like has just set the world alight, like this cricketer's going to be amazing. And she is, and she's gone on to have an incredible career. But we were all just like, okay. So we had like that moment of silence, and then our head coach was like, it's not how you start a tournament, it's how you finish. Like, you've got to pull yourselves together and everyone fight and turn up tomorrow, basically. And that was what we did. And we just sort of like, okay, let's ignore that result. Didn't happen. You know, if we win every game from here on in, we win the World Cup. And it was just positivity. We had that like 10 minutes of being like, whoa. And then it was just positive mindset, go into everything. And then personally, it was such a whirlwind. And it doesn't really feel like me or my career, because as I said, cricket was such a funny one for me. But everyone always says, you know, the best thing will be winning it. If you win it, it'll be the best feeling. And nothing in my life, I don't think, will ever compare to it, because it was just everything you've ever worked for as a kid, everything you've ever dreamed of, playing at Lourdes in front of a full house, everyone chanting and cheering your name. I mean, it was so, so good. Like, just that feeling of, I think it was relief as well, because it was always like, we've done it. Like, all eyes have been on us for such a long time that we've done it. And yeah, doing the lap of honour was such a privilege, because, you know, so many young girls and boys that all wanted to try on the medal, all wanted autographs. And I remember the rain started falling and all our family and friends were waiting at the pavilion, but we'd gone the other way. And I was last, and mum and dad were like, where is she? The rain's falling, like, what's she doing? But I made sure I'd signed every single autograph, because I wanted to make sure that, you know, if I missed one person, it's not fair that I then go and sign someone else's. So I sort of went round and just took my time and shared a bottle of champagne with a few people in the crowd. it was just amazing.
Oh, how cool. How'd you celebrate after?
In the way you can imagine. I drank a magnum of champagne on the lap of honour, and I don't remember anything else, which is a shame. So our whole thing was for 4 years singing the team song at Lourdes. And the only thing I remember was Kate Cross, my best friend, giving me a chicken drumstick saying, eat that or you'll regret it. And I said, F off, and threw it into the bin. And I don't remember singing the team song, and I got put to bed at 10 p.m. and I really regret it.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, devastating. Wow. Yeah. Tell me though, playing at Lourdes for that final, what was the atmosphere like? Can you describe the feeling of when you actually did win and you were like, oh my gosh, how have we done this? Just walk me through the emotional layer of that.
I think the start of the day when we turned up, there was people queuing to get in the ground, and that I'd never seen that before, especially for women's cricket. I was like, hang on a minute, all these people are coming to watch us. And with my like anxiety, I always focused on the empty patches in a stand. I'd be like, okay, if I look at that empty block of seats, in my mind, it means no one's here and I'm just playing with my friends. So day of the final, I'm warming up, and Heather Knight, the captain, comes up to me and taps me on the shoulder. She goes, are you okay? Knowing that I get quite anxious. I said, yeah, I'm fine. I'm just going to look at the empty seats. She went, sold out, Alex. There aren't going to be any empty seats. And I was like, well, what am I going to do? I was like, what am I going to do? She's like, you'll be absolutely fine. Do whatever you've always done. You'll be fine. And I was like, okay. She was like, I trust you. And I was like, those words, I was like, okay, that calmed me down. I was like, okay, no worries. And then the crowd started to build. And then it's like, where are my parents sat? Where are all the family and friends? So that you sort of have that, you go, oh, there's my comfort zone. Yeah. And then I just remember seeing the national anthem. I've never felt anything like it. It was just such a moving thing. You know, the big screen playing with all the past women on it that had played at Lourdes or played and represented England. And it was just pure pride and pure like elation to be there, and sort of, wow, this is the moment that really could change women's cricket in England. So yeah, it was incredible. And then that was the build up to the game. The build up was like almost like, God, can we get on with it now? The game itself ended up being a low scoring thriller. India should have won. And the rain was coming in, and I remember thinking, okay, if we stay ahead of Duckworth Lewis, Stern, that's fine. But there was a real moment where we thought we'd have to come back the next day and finish it. Because if the game got cancelled, you just came back the next day and sort of finished the game off. And we were like, oh God, if it rains now, we are going to have to come back tomorrow. And then Anya Shrubsall, England's hero, she just won it for us. And it was just incredible. And that feeling of running towards your teammates from, I was at a final, like they were all already in a huddle and just jumping on them was just the best feeling in the world.
Ah, so cool. You mentioned, you know, how you're used to seeing a few empty seats in a stadium. Tell me how much women's cricket has just exploded over the last few years. It's just literally gone all guns blazing, and it's so exciting to see. But for you, what do you make of that? What does that mean to you? What excites you about, you know, the potential of where the women's game is going?
I couldn't be more proud of the organisers and the administrators of where they've taken women's cricket, not just in England, in India, in Australia, where the game was 10 years ago to where it is now. I mean, we've just had the 100 auction and we've had two overseas girls got £220,000, which is more than any of the men's overseas in the auction, by the way. They all went at less than £200,000. And one of our domestic girls going at £190,000. And I couldn't be more proud. I think it's just incredible where the game's gone. You know, you think I retired because I'm going to be honest, my cricket contract was £18,000 a year. And I was expected to train full time and play every single game. And then 3 years, not even 3 years later, someone's earning £190,000 for a month's work. And someone said to me the other day, like, are you jealous? And I'm like, I'm not jealous. I'm really, really proud. Obviously, there's a tiny little part of me that wishes I had a month of that.
Yeah,
but
God,
everybody's, you know, get that Cartier ring, girl, like whatever I wanted, you know. But I couldn't be more proud of where the game's at and the girls that are still involved. And it's just amazing to see where it will be. You know, the smaller nations, New Zealand, South Africa, they're catching up to the likes of England, Australia and India. So the game's in an amazing place.
Absolutely. And I mean, you definitely shouldn't be jealous. I mean, I can understand why you would be, because it's just like, oh, wow, I wish I had a little bit of part of that. But, you know, you really set the stage. You were part of building what we're seeing right now, which is the most amazing part of it all. Like, without you girls sticking through it and you know, making the changes that need to happen and needed to happen, you know, you allowed for the game to become what it is.
Yeah, and I think you look at, you know, Rachel Hayhoe Flynn and then Charlotte Edwards, Sarah Taylor, and then my generation, it all changes, you know. If it wasn't for Rachel Hayhoe Flynn, there wouldn't have been a Women's World Cup. If it wasn't for Charlotte Edwards leading in the capacity that she did and doing everything she has done for the game, obviously she's back as England Women's Head Coach now, which is an incredible appointment. You know, things change and everything happens for a reason, and there is no part of me that wishes I was still playing. You know, I was watching that auction going, would I want to play in front of £15,000, in front of 15,000 people for that amount of money? No, I'm very, very happy commentating on the sidelines. I'm just really proud of where everyone has taken the game to.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk to me about the 100, though. What an amazing tournament this is becoming. I mean, it's so exciting. I feel like it's just getting bigger and bigger every year. A lot of these tournaments are, but I just feel like this one's really making a lot of noise. Tell me, what makes it special? What do you enjoy about it? I've never been, but it looks so much fun. You've got the fun element.
Yeah, and I think that's what it is, you know, and especially for women's cricket, it's taken it to the next level. You know, it was at a stage a couple of years ago where the 100 crowds were 10, 12, 14,000 people for a domestic game, and the England crowds were 4, 5, 6,000 people. So it's completely changed women's cricket. All those people now come to international games. That sort of happened by accident during COVID. So the girls and the boys weren't meant to play double headers, but COVID sort of made it happen, and it was a huge success, so they've kept it. But the fact that it's, you know, a tournament that's a day out at the cricket, it's not men's or women's cricket, it's a day at the cricket watching your team, you get 6 hours of cricket for £30, you know, it's amazing. The so many kids, it's trying to attract a new audience, which I think it has done, trying to get more people into the game. The men's competition is sort of, I'm excited to see where that is this year, because it's sort of, it's not been one of the best competitions in the world with the caliber of the overseas and the money that was involved until this year, until it been privatized. It was sort of, well, the women are getting the best overseas in the world. They're attracting, you know, the crowd, not all the crowds, but they're attracting big crowds. So I'm excited to see what it goes like now where it's been bought privately. You've got the best men's overseas, the best women's overseas. It's going to be incredible. But for the women's game in particular, it's come on leaps and bounds. You know, it's been amazing for the game to see it develop, to see the young kids come through. There's a young girl called Tilly Courtine Coleman. She's just gone for over £100,000. She's 18 years old. I mean, it's completely life-changing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a significant amount of money for, you know, such a small chunk of the year when you really look at it, right?
Mm, yeah. I mean, I think when you think of these young kids and think of how good they could be and the athletes that they are now at 18, you know, they could actually still be playing in 20 years' time.
Yeah. They really could. They absolutely
Yeah. Yeah, you think, you know, you look at like the likes of Ravi Bapara, who's only just retired 40.
Yes, exactly. I mean, athletes and, you know, are lasting so much longer, especially in the game of cricket. It's crazy that you think that, you know, someone being so talented at just 18 years old, you just go, wow, you have got a whole adventure ahead of you.
Exactly.
Now, you mentioned privatization. I want to talk to you a little bit about this because BBL is looking to do the exact same thing. What's your opinion of it? Do you think it's a good thing for these tournaments to when they get to a point where they're big enough to move and shift into that realm?
Look, there's got to be a point where you want to attract the best players to come to your tournaments, and I think the BBL, the men's comp in particular, over the last couple of years hasn't attracted the best overseas. It's quite a long tournament. So it's like, how do we make our competition better? It's pumping more money into it. And I know some people will think, well, can it not just stand on its own? Can, you know, Cricket Australia not just support it? But they don't have unlimited resources. They don't have unlimited money. So there's got to be a point that if you want it to be the best comp in the world and attract the best players, you've got to pump the money into it. And unfortunately, that's the only way that I can see it going, is to privatise a lot of these competitions. And yes, you know, Mumbai Indians might own, you know, four or five different teams across the world, but you might see that somebody like Phil Salt, for example, or Riley Meredith, they might end up being franchise professionals and sign for like the Mumbai Indians and go and play all the comps. So then when they're back in Australia or England, they have to get their own S&C, their own physio, but they can afford it because they're being paid loads of money.
You see a lot of players that do now have, you know, those contracts where they go, okay, we're going to play here, we're going to play here, we're going to play here, but it's all going to be under, for argument's sake, the Mumbai Indians franchise. I mean, it's exciting. I think it's really cool, the fact that you can have such high-end level talent in a variety of different tournaments that, you know, bring the X factor.
It's exciting, but it's also a little bit worrying, isn't it? You know, what is the incentive for young kids growing up now to want to play domestic cricket and want to play Red Bull cricket or Test match cricket? So there is like that fine line of, yes, these competitions are amazing. They earn all these people so much money. They're exciting to watch. I love watching the IPL, the PSL, everything, the MLC, all these competitions I love. But a young kid that is now 16, 17 years old, or maybe slightly old, Cooper Connolly, for example, what is the incentive for somebody like him to want to play Red Bull cricket when the money he's earning elsewhere is just, you can't really compete?
Such a good point. I mean, when you are, and you would know more than what I do, but when you are, you know, grassroots and you're aspiring to be, you know, the next big thing, or, you know, take on the sport and thrive, and you look at your goals and go, what do I want to be? I feel like it'd be really interesting to go to, you know, kids in grassroots level cricket and ask them, what is your goal? Do you want to play for your country, or is it, oh no, I want to be a franchise cricket player? I wonder what the ratio between the two is, because at the end of the day, these players are making so much money tournament hopping. And I wonder if they go, I'm not going to play for my country. I'm just going to do franchise cricket and that's going to be me.
And we are seeing it happen, you know, the people from South Africa retiring to play franchise cricket and these countries that can't compete. Pat Cummins came out and said, there's only so long that my generation of player is going to want to pick test match cricket over the money. But I think if you ask young kids, what do you want to be when you grow up? They'd be like, I want to be Joss Butler, or I want to be, you know, Glenn Maxwell. It wouldn't be, I want to play for Australia. I think it'd be, I want to be like a certain player.
Yeah, totally. For you, did you want to be like a certain player or did you want to just play for your country?
I wanted to play for England men. I didn't even know England women had a team when I first started playing. I was that naive and I was such a tomboy that I wanted to play for England men. And then when I found out the women played, I was like, okay, that's my goal. That's what I want to do.
I love that though. I mean, to be fair to you, you were playing with all the boys when you were growing up in every sport. So fair play. I can understand that.
Yeah, when I used to visualise me playing cricket for England or whatever, it wasn't with a group of girls, it was with a group of boys.
I love that though, so good. Oh. Yeah. We're going to step away for a short break, but we'll return soon, so stay right there. Well, I think we should have a bit of fun. We've got down to all of the, you know, nitty-gritty stuff. But this game is called Red Light, Green Light. I don't know if you know it. So if you, you know, you can either red light something I say or you can green light something I say. You know, the world's your oyster.
Okay. I'm intrigued. I'm nervous.
Okay. Let's do it. So every cricket match should have mic'd up players.
Oh, green light.
Oh, tell me why. You got to tell me why. Give it to.
Okay. I love the insight you get from a player on a mic, whether or not they're bowling. You think of when Shane Warne used to do it, right? I was glued to the TV when he'd be like, I'm just going to bowl a flipper or I'm going to try and bowl a googly. It was the best thing I'd ever watched. And I learned so much from it. I was like this young kid that was going, oh my God, this is amazing. Also, you get the personality when players come across on the mic. I think it's brilliant.
Do you ever get worried what you're going to say? I think I'd just say something really rogue accidentally, like I'd fall over.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
I said shit on air on the player mic, but you know.
It could be a worse. Yeah.
Exactly. You just sort of go, sorry about that.
Okay. But you do like it. We're green lining it.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Okay. Podcasting with a teammate is harder than playing with them.
Oh, I've got a podcast with a teammate. So I think the podcasting with a teammate is easier than playing because my example was it was either me or Crossy that was in the team and England either played the extra seamer or the extra spinner. So we sort of never really played together. We only ever played one international together, which was wild. So yeah, I think podcasting is easier.
Love it. Every cricketer secretly wants to try commentary.
I'm going to red light that one because some people do not want to talk for a living.
At all. Have you been on the receiving end when you've just tried to ask a player some questions and they just give you donuts?
Yes. Oh. How intimidating is it though? And also you're like, come on, just help me out. I'm trying
especially
to do my job.
You know them and you've had like, you know, a bit of banter beforehand. Like I always try and like have like a little bit of a chat before we go on live and I just make sure everyone's comfortable. And then when they just stand there and go, yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
I'm like, bro, what are you doing right now?
Yeah, I had one last year. I'd never spoken to Sam Curran before. And I didn't really know what he was going to be like, but I was really nervous. I don't know why. I was just really nervous for this one interview. So I'm like, I'm like, how are you? He's like, yeah, good, thank you. Are you? And I was like, yeah, I'm good. And I was like, oh no, if our chat's like this, it's going to be really painful. I was like, Sam, start at the 100, how are you? And he was brilliant. And I was like, oh, that's what every interview should be. Because it is acting. You know, we have to act. You sort of go, welcome.
You could be having the worst day of your life. And you're like, hi, everyone. Welcome. This is great. We're all really happy.
Yeah, just had a mental breakdown. That's fine.
No one knows. We're smiling, waving.
Yeah. Yeah, so not every player wants to commentate.
No, I agree with that. Okay, women's cricket should have its own standalone World Test Championship.
Is it not having its own test championship? Oh, no, it's having its own champions trophy. I'm going to red light that one because I don't think every nation is good enough to play test cricket yet. And I don't think every cricket board would be willing to pay for test cricket. I think New Zealand are a great example of it. You know, Sophie Devine has played for however 20 years, never played a test match. They can't afford it. They don't want to play test match cricket. They have the same match fees, which is almost a detriment because it means they're definitely not going to play test cricket. So as much as I would love more test cricket in the women's game, I don't think every nation should play a test championship. I might get castrated for that one.
I think you explained it well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It comes down to money and profit.
Yeah, which makes a lot of sense. Like the game actually has to make money as well. You can't just be losing money all the time. It's got to make sense.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Social media beef between players makes sport more interesting.
Oh, I mean, it does. Yes. Green light. Because how great is it when you see, you know, someone slag someone off and then you go, oh, they're playing each other on Sunday. Yeah. Let's tune in.
Right. Especially for us in the media landscape, we're like, bold. Thank you very much for giving us a little ticket of a golden nugget.
Exactly. So, yeah, I love it. Obviously, it's not great for the game, but I love it.
I agree. Former players make the best commentators.
Red light, that one. I think you can be one of the best players in the world, but if you can't articulate how you did something or you can't explain, like some of these players who have been so good just did it. You know, they'd be like, that's like the best players don't make the best coaches either. You've got to be able to talk about the game. So, I think if you can't get your words out in the right way or explain things, I think you've got to dumb cricket down a bit when you're on air. If you can't do that, then you're going to be a hard listen. And also some people's voices are just so hard to listen to. Mine included.
No, it's not. No, it's
not. Oh, my God. It is.
In radio, your voice was hard to listen to. That's all we're hearing.
Yeah.
Okay, it's more fun to coach than be coached.
Oh, it's more fun to coach than be coached. It depends where you're at in your career for me. I loved being coached because I always wanted to get better and always wanted to sort of add new things into my game. To coach, it depends if you want to do it. So coaching for me has never been something that I want to do long term. So it was never like, and I find a lot of coaches are in it for themselves. They'll try and change something in somebody's action to make them look good. Make themselves look good. I think that's a really hard thing to, as a coach, you're not going to get a reputation of being great unless you start implementing good things, but you can't change everybody. So I think being coached, because it's just, I found that easier.
Fair enough. All right. Autocorrect ruins more text than it saves.
It saves me. So
me
I'm going to red light that one.
Me
I've too. Got dyslexia.
Where
I can't
are?
Spell. Yeah.
So, I would be screwed without autocorrect.
Oh, my God. Yeah, no. If I didn't have autocorrect, people would be like, did she ever go to school? And honestly, I did. I've just got problems.
Yeah.
You sometimes have to use the Siri to spell a word where you say it into your phone as well.
Little microphone thing. I will definitely be using that. If I'm sitting there for a minute going, okay, this is just, it's not even coming up with autocorrect of the options. This is completely off with what the word I'm trying to actually spell. So the microphone is in use very frequently with
me. Yes. I'm glad you're the same.
Yeah. I'm a big caller over Texas, so I can just avoid the texting situation.
Okay. I like a voice note or a video note.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Voice note I'm into. Voice note, call. Call I love because it's like, okay, just tell me what you need. Okay, great. I'll go do it.
But I think if you rang me, I'd be like, why is Grace ringing? Is everything okay? And I'd let it ring and I'd be like, sorry, hon, missed your call. You okay?
least you're honest.
And then and you'd be like, yeah, I just want to see if you're okay.
Chat. So good. Oh, my God. Oh. Okay, well, I'm never ringing you. God damn.
No. You'll be like, I've got this amazing opportunity.
I'm going to do it intentionally now.
Yeah.
Just test what you're going to do.
Yeah, I just wanted to invite you for a coffee. Oh,
yeah, hi. We're going to take one last break. We'll be right back after this. Well, let's go to the final part of the podcast. This is called The Final Whistle. So pretty much I'm just going to rapid fire some questions at you and you just rapid fire your responses back and then we'll wrap it up. Okay. What's something that's changed your mind about sport recently?
I watched the Rory McIlroy documentary and there was a psychologist on there and he said the fear of failure will kill you. Basically saying that if you're constantly in a mindset of failing, you're going to fail and that will kill you as a sports person. So think of the exciting things you could achieve or if you take on a problem head on, think of the exciting outcome rather than failing at it, if that makes sense. And I was like, I wish I knew that 5 years ago.
Could have been playing in the 100, just earning a shitload.
God damn.
God damn it, Rory. Why couldn't you have released this earlier?
Why couldn't you have won the Masters 10 years ago?
What the heck? Honestly.
Yeah.
Take it out with
rude.
You.
Rude.
So rude. What's the best piece of advice you've ever gotten from a coach?
Excitement and anxiety are the same nerves. It's how you perceive them in your head. So if you get those butterflies in your belly, think of it as excitement and you're excited to go out on the field rather than I'm going to be sick. I feel really nervous.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Alternatively, what do you think is the best advice you've given as a coach?
I think the sun will still come up tomorrow, whether you have the worst game of your life or the best game, you know, it's just a game of cricket. I remember last year at the PSL, one of our lads on a Saturday got 5 spit, bowled really, really well. And then on the Tuesday, got none for 70. And he came to me, he's like, I'm the worst bowler in the world. I don't know what to do. I was like, hang on a minute. Two days ago, you just got 5 for. I said, and the sun comes up tomorrow and it's fine. We start again. It's not a problem. It's just a game. So I think the sun still comes up tomorrow. Just enjoy it for what it is. You're going to have good days and bad days. You just got to accept them.
I like that. Which former teammate would you want on your trivia team?
There's Anya Shrubsall. She is a fountain of all knowledge, I reckon. Anya Shrubsall, for me, she knows everything.
Wow, you wouldn't want me because I've got no idea.
No, I haven't. I used to sit there in silence during a team quiz and just go.
Someone else please answer. Please.
Yeah, we used to have to hand our phones and I'd be like, now I really can't answer a question.
God damn it. Google can't save me.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, fair. Okay, we're not playing trivia. What is a guilty pleasure you refuse to feel guilty about?
I think watching no other sport but cricket. I am such a loser for the game. And people always go, what other sport do you watch? I'm like, nothing. I watch everything from T10 to Test Match Cricket. It's on every day. If the PSL game starts at 2 and an IPL game starts at 3, I'll watch both. I'm a proper loser, but I love it.
Fair enough. I mean, I'm not that deep, but I definitely get where you're coming from.
Yeah.
I feel the vibe. Okay, what's your go-to karaoke song?
I have never done karaoke.
Yes, you have. That is such a lie. You definitely have. What?
I've done it once in America during the T20 World Cup out there and I can't repeat the song I did, but it was Tenacious D. And I embarrassed myself because I was swearing every 2 seconds. So I don't think I'll ever do it again.
Yeah, fair. I mean, I would definitely not get up there. My voice would just deafen everyone. It'd be no good.
No, I'm like a strangled cat. No, thank you.
Same. Yeah. All right. Last, what is your most used emoji?
I think it's a laughing face.
Mm.
Or sometimes the pervy dribble one.
What, the one that like melts in? Like the melting
the,
one?
No, the one that dribbles outside of his mouth. Mm. Yeah. Mm.
What context were you using that for, Alex?
Like, it depends where in the world I am. So let's just go with the laughing face.
Let's just go with the laughing face. I love it. Oh, well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Really appreciate having you. It's been such a laugh as always. But yeah, you're an absolute gem. Thank you so much for your time.
No, thanks for having me, guys. It's been good fun.
That's all for the episode of Game On with Grace. I hope you loved this conversation as much as I did. Alex is an absolute gem, so thank you again for her to join and spend her time talking to us. But make sure you hit that follow button and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast. Share the episode with a friend because we've got so many more legendary guests, hilarious debates, and big stories coming your way. So stay tuned. I'm Grace Hayden, and until next time, keep competitive.